Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
You're listening to a Count Out Podcast.
What it is, what's up, and welcome everyone to Faces and Feels. I'm your host, Rafe Houston, and today I'm joined by a very special guest. Now, when he's not tearing it up on Twitch under the wrestling referee on Rock Band, in a previous life he was once known as, one of the original deathmatch referees and really just an all-round legendary figure within wrestling, and that is the one and only John Gray. Brother, I want to thank you for finally having the time to jump on here with me and chat it up.
I appreciate you having me. It's a pleasure, and I look forward to it, man. I don't like the legendary part too much, but I appreciate the accolade, man. It's a pleasure.
Look, I know you told me that you don't like that stuff, but that's how everybody I know refers to you. So I was still going to hit you with it, and plus I got to big up my guests and make them feel good. So
I do appreciate it. It's humbling. Thank you very much.
Well, absolutely, bud. But let's waste no time. Let's jump into it, man, because there was a long run there, and I'd love to get through all of it with you, especially with me starting work in, very soon. let's rewind all the way back like I always do, buddy. So when you think back to when you first got into professional wrestling, what were some of the larger-than-life, faces that stood out to you that caught your interest initially?
So I've talked about this on a few podcasts. I grew up in the 80s, and I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. It was a hotbed for, and I believe they weren't quite the USWA at the time, or maybe if they were, they had just transitioned into becoming the USWA. But Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee and, I never got to see him work, but he was definitely at the building and doing different stuff here and there. Toto Yamamoto and, of course, Eddie Marlin and Jeff Jarrett, of course. I watched him as a referee before he started wrestling for his father. So the Louisville Gardens was just a big impact for me, professional wrestling-wise, not to mention all the stuff that we were able to watch on, television. WWF at the time, they had prime time on Mondays and Tuesday Night Titans on Tuesdays, and ESPN was becoming a thing, and they were showing like World Class or AWA, or there was always some type of wrestling on TV in the middle of the afternoon after school growing up. So plus, Tuesdays at the Garden. So I like to say that I grew up in an era when wrestling was hot in the 80s, rock and wrestling and the whole nine. It was a good time in the 80s to be a wrestling fan.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's I always talk about this and kind of the difference growing up as like an Australian fan versus, you know, the people and friends I have in America, because, you know, you're in it and around it and it's on TV and Hulkamania is running wild and you're doing all that stuff. And I'm renting VHS tapes and I'm seeing all that, but it is not replicated within the streets of my town. You know what I mean? Nobody knows what the fuck I'm talking about, nor do they care. So how was it like being a part of that? Like I always try and understand the, like you say, the boom, it was hot. Everyone's talking about it. Are kids at school wearing wrestling shirts? Is it like just everywhere?
No.
No, still not.
I was the outcast. I was made fun of.
Oh, really?
I took WWF had these trading cards in 87, mm-hmm. 88, and I had the whole set, mm-hmm. and I would take them to school and show them off, and people would make fun of me. Oh, that's so fake. I can't believe you get into that, and you know, whatever.
Really?
I gave two shits. I did not care. I was enthralled by it. The larger than life characters, the athleticism, you know, I knew after watching my first show, I didn't know what, but I knew that's what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted something to do with this industry from a very young age. Mm-hmm. I knew that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so you were able to see wrestling live from a very young age, yeah? You were able to be there and be in the crowd and feel it?
Every Tuesday.
Every Tuesday. Wow.
Every Tuesday. It was the one thing, even if I had bad grades or I was bad and I was grounded, my parents, God rest their souls, my parents made sure I was there every Tuesday night, because they knew how important it was to me to be a part of that crowd and to have that.
Were they wrestling fans as well? Did they enjoy going and having a yell and doing all that?
No. So no. my stepdad would watch it on TV,
sure.
And you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was cool with it, but you know, like they were not huge fans, and I'm sure we'll talk about it later. But you know, when I first started getting into wrestling, they were very much not supportive.
Oh.
And it wasn't until many years later,
mm-hmm.
That they kind of came around to it,
mm-hmm.
and understood, you know, no matter what anybody else thought or said, this was the path that I had chosen, mm-hmm. and fail or succeed, I was going to see it through.
Absolutely.
And I think at some point they garnered some sort of respect in that.
Yeah. Got you. How does that transition happen then? So you're a kid, you know, you're going to see it regularly. Like you say, it's every Tuesday, you're really into it. How old are you before you are able to start to maybe go help out or figure out what your path is going to be there? Were you like a sporty kid? Were you thinking you were going to wrestle, or were you always looking for like another way to be involved?
So I did wrestle in high school, mm-hmm. My freshman year. I was not good. I was awful. I was like 0-7 my freshman year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the longest I lasted in a match was like, I don't know, 55 seconds, less than a minute. I know it was less than a minute. I never made it a minute.
And you're speaking now of like what they refer to as amateur wrestling. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like Greco-Roman style. It's not a thing that we have like as a sport here in Australia, but I know like in high schools, like it's a thing, right?
Yeah. I was not good at it, but I kept at it. Mm-hmm. You know, I did it my freshman and sophomore years, and you know, it was just something to be a part of.
Yeah.
You know, even if nothing else, I was learning something that may be valuable later to me.
Sure. Yeah.
So, from there, you know, to answer the first part of your question, how do we transition into actually getting into it? Brian Benson, and well, it kind of goes before that, but IWA Mid-South, I got to give the devil his due. I mean, the reality of it is that's kind of where the root was kind of firmly planted. Okay. And doors became open, although not within an IWA, through people that were going there that I became friends with and that I put myself in front of, and not always in the best way. Admittedly, my mouth brought a lot of checks. My ass couldn't cash back then.
Yeah. Right.
On the flip side of that, you know, I was also able to put myself in the face of promoters and certain promoters' sons. And Brian Vinson, who was a backyard guy by the name of Warlock, me and him had a conversation, and I started doing backyard stuff, and that led to doing stuff in the backyards with JC Bailey. And that led to a Bad to the Bone wrestling show in Louisville, where a referee didn't show up. And Rick Brady, Isaiah, and JC Bailey all went to Joe Bailey and was like, "Hey, you got a ref sitting in the front row. Give him his money back and pay for his license. And, you know, you got a ref." And that's legitimately how my start happened. I was sitting in an audience at a show, supporting my friends. Yeah. And 5 minutes later, I'm in the locker room in a pair of khaki pants and a referee shirt.
Yeah. Just there you go. Straight into it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I was not good. I botched every finish that night, every one of them. But Joe and JC brought me back, and I stuck with it. That floundered into something else, you know. But as far as like being formally trained as a referee, that never happened.
Yeah,
for me, my training came in the ring on the fly,
figuring it
you
out.
You know, by sitting my pants. Yeah, figure it out.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I would guess that even though it was, you know, ICW, we're not talking about death matches straight out the gate, right? Like, we're talking about in the ring, standard, straight up wrestling. Yeah.
So Kentucky was very weird at the time. Mm-hmm. They had not completely outlawed death matches at that particular time. That came maybe a year or so later. So I got to dabble a little bit in some glass and, you know, this, that, and the other, but it was very sparingly and not as often as it would become in the latter part of my career.
Yeah. Absolutely. And how were you feeling all about it? Like you said, you're figuring it out. You're by the seat of your pants, just like, what am I doing, sort of thing. Were you feeling really positive about it? Were you like, I can do this. I can get better. I want to keep going. Loving it.
For the most part, yeah. Like I had some hiccups. Certainly the very first match that I ever did. Cowboy Chris Cartwright and a guy by the name of the Regulator, George Robinson, God rest his soul. They were doing a match, and if my memory serves me correct, I wasn't supposed to see a gimmick, or maybe I wasn't supposed to see both gimmicks. I don't remember, but I turned to face the judge, who was the manager, and judge is telling me, don't turn around, don't turn around, don't turn around. And what do? I flip around. And both of these guys have a weapon, and they both use them at the same time. or maybe it was one after the other. I don't remember, but they both wound up using their weapons.
Yeah.
And I threw the match out. I disqualified them both. Yeah. And they took turns tatering me for like 5 minutes in the ring, just beating the living shit out of me.
And it was stiff.
it was. And I still had to come back out and do the other four or five matches on the night.
Yeah,
you know, wow. I was literally, this was my first show and I had just been thrown into it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I to say I learned the hard way very quickly is an understatement. I learned a lot of quick lessons very, very hard.
Yeah.
And very quickly. So, but there were certainly times where I questioned, boy, did I make the right career path? is this really what I want to do? You know, but it was.
Yeah.
No matter what happened, I always came back for more.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess this is around the time that you're coming back to the family and being like, I'm refereeing kind of thing. And they're like looking at you like, what are you doing?
Yeah. Well, they certainly knew. Mm-hmm. They knew I was doing some stuff and, you know, they had seen a couple of things advertised locally and knew that I was going to be there and this, that. And they saw the rep shirts, you know, but mm-hmm. They still were not on board.
Yeah.
My mom didn't come watch a show with me on it. I started in 1998. Mm-hmm. She came and watched a show for the first time in 2003.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Wow.
And my dad got to see me for the first time in 2006 mm-hmm. on TV.
Yeah, okay.
For an Ohio Valley, a local show here in Louisville, Ohio Valley Wrestling, mm-hmm. And you know that he called me shortly after, and what was so weird about that is we were not on speaking terms at the time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of things going on, and we just weren't speaking.
Mm-hmm.
But he called me and he said, "Hey, Johnny, I want you to know I just saw this, and I'm proud of you, bud."
That's nice.
I take that back. He didn't say he was proud of me. He said he was happy for me.
Mm.
The proud of me thing comes many years later, and that's even more cool because that came after a Black Craft show.
Yeah.
And, you know, I came home from, I think it was Pittsburgh. We stopped in on our way home from Pittsburgh, or maybe it was the Buffalo show. But, mm-hmm. you know, wherever it was, I told him about it. And I was mm-hmm. just like, yeah, you know, I got to work with, you know, this guy that played the in head. And I got to, you know, I got to do this ladder match. And,
yeah.
you know, I got to work with John I got to work with John Morrison and. Mm-hmm. You know, this and that, and, you know, like, I'm really, you know, I'm super excited about where I'm going, Dad. And,
mm-hmm.
That was the first time he told me he was proud of me, but that, so. You know, it kind of came full circle at that moment, you know, it was like, you know, I wasn't so much doing it for their approval,
yeah.
you know, but to have that validation was very important to me.
Absolutely. To just have them understand, you know what I mean? To understand that this was important to me and it's something that I love to do and that's why I've done it. You know, I feel like everybody sort of craves that understanding, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's continue on because you told me some sort of funny stories before we turned on the mic, but you were telling me about some sort of crazier people that you've worked with and how you got like the main event ref Monica. So at which point do you go from like, you know, these kind of crazy ICW shows where you're getting beat up for looking at weapons and blowing finishes to, you know, reffing shows with like Shawn Michaels on it and Sting and stuff. That's right. Wild.
So that came by chance. I was catting around Louisville, Kentucky, doing some stuff for a local group called think it was All Pro Wrestling. Mm-hmm. It was owned by Jay and Brian Walker. Mm-hmm. And they somehow got hooked up into this church show where Ted DiBiase and the Road Warriors, Buff Bagwell and Greg Valentine were going to be, you know, the headliners. And wow. they needed to support, you know, supply the undercard. Mm-hmm.
What kind of year is this?
This would have been in 2003.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Brian comes up to me, he's like, hey, you know, we're going to need a rep for this, you know, would you mind coming in? And mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, sure. You know, whatever you need, whatever. So I show up and, there were some things that almost prevented me from being able to be there legally. I was not a very good boy the day before.
Oh no!
By the grace of God, I got to the show, mm-hmm. and to do the story justice, I kind of got to tell the whole thing. But Ted, I'm in the locker room. I'm pissed off at the world, and mm-hmm. Ted DiBiase comes in and he wants to pray with everybody. Now, up to this point, the only thing I've been told about this show is that these guys are headlining and it's at a church. Mm-hmm. I had never been told DiBiase was a preacher, mm-hmm. didn't know nothing about his ministry, didn't know anything about the Road Warriors being Christian, certainly not Buff Bagwell or mm-hmm. Greg Ballard. I was there to get my, you know, $75 and see y'all later. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Ted comes in. He wants to do this little prayer, and I don't want to pray. Okay, I don't want to pray. Mm-hmm. So I stood up. I walked out. They do their little thing, and Ted comes out the locker or comes out to the hallway right after, and he approaches me and you know introduces himself. I introduce myself back and mm-hmm. says, you know, I've done a lot of these things and. Nobody ever walked out on a prayer.
Yeah.
Like mm-hmm. usually they just, you know, I'm like, yeah, no.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people would just sort of stand there and just sort of let it happen or whatever. But obviously you were feeling a certain kind of way in that moment and felt like you didn't want to hear it, you know? And so he probably as a person is kind of like, that's a pretty visceral reaction. Maybe a conversation, you know, needs to be had with him, make sure he's okay kind of thing, you know? Especially, you know, he's a man of God. He's caring about people.
Right. And you know, he did ask me, he's like, you know, are you okay? And I told him, yeah, but I'm just here to get a payday. I'm not here for whatever it is y'all are trying to spend.
Sure.
I need to do my job. I need to get my money and I need to go home. Mm-hmm. Okay. And with that, he turned around and walked away.
Yeah.
Okay. And the only thing that went through my mind is, oh, God damn it, dude, you just blew your only chance at probably ever getting out of this little, you know, Louisville scene that you're in right now. Mm. So we go out, we do the deal. Some things happen. And afterwards, me and him come back together. He winds up giving me his personal cell phone number. And he asked me to call him later in the week, to which I do. Mm-hmm. Okay. And from there, a relationship grew. He took me to quite a few shows, one of which being this show at the Detroit World Outreach, where the main event was Sting and Road Warrior Animal, because this was right after Mike Hedgefriend, Road Warrior Hawks, passing against Buff Bagwell and Greg Valentine, I think it was. Yeah. So they bring me in on a Greyhound. They meet me there. We're at this, please forgive me. We're at this Six Flags Over Jesus type place. I mean, it's just this humongous mega church. And I mean, they're really nice people. It's a really nice place. It's called the Detroit World Outreach. If you're ever in Detroit, please check the place out. It was just, you know, one of those mega churches. And at the time, I had never really seen a mega church. So
it was a lot.
The first thing. Mm-hmm. It was a lot for me to take in. Mm-hmm. you know, like they had this little homeless place, and like there was like individualized like locker dressing areas. I mean, it was just so weird for me, mm-hmm. you know, and like they pick me up and somebody's carrying my bags and they're making conversation with me, like just all these things that are out of the realm of the norm of your average independent show sure. in the 90s, early 2000s, that just was not happening mm-hmm. on the norm.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we get up to the locker room area and we come to this door and it says like other wrestlers and referees. And I'm like, oh, cool. This is me. Mm-hmm. And I go to go into this room and the guy's like, no, you're down here. I'm like, no, this definitely says referees right here. And
I can say
I'm a ref.
Yeah, yeah.
He says, your name's John Gray, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. He says, you're down here. So we go up five or six doors, and on this door is a list of, you know, all the main event people, mm-hmm. Sting and Shawn Michaels and Ted DiBiase, Animal, my name, Buff Bagwell, Brett. You know, my name's on this door with these stars.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just like, whoa. Okay. So I go in and I'm sitting. We have our own, like I said, they had their own individual, like, dressing areas, you know, and I'm mm-hmm. right smack between Animal and Sean and right across from Sting. Mm-hmm. And I'm having a conversation, and it's been so many years now, I don't remember with who. Mm-hmm. I'm telling him about who, you know, what's going on and all this. And, you know, like, I guess Sean overheard me kind of, you know, bragging about it or whatever. And he said, well, you're in the locker room with the main event stars, so I guess that makes you the main event referee. And it, you know, the wrong person heard that. It took off. And, you know, so that was kind of a thing for a little while. And it was funny. It was cool. Mm-hmm. I'm betting $1 trillion Shawn Michaels does not remember this interaction.
Sure.
I personally am never going to forget it because yeah. that, you know, that whole day for me was a once in a lifetime thing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm being in a room with that much star power mm-hmm. at that point in my career, I had no right to be there. Mm-hmm. And I was so honored to be.
Yeah.
And you could definitely tell I was a nervous wreck in the ring. You can find this match on YouTube.
Yeah.
It's under Sting Save Shawn Michaels or Shawn Michaels Save Sting, something of that nature. Uh-huh. Look it up. The referee is me, and I am just extremely nervous.
I guess DiBiase put you there, right? Because he wanted to chat to yeah. you or whatever. He was like, oh, just drop John in with me kind of thing. And I can, you know, we can hang right. out or whatever,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the other cool thing about that show was after we did the little meet and greet and Ted asked me if I wanted to join them, and I knew nobody was going to ask me for an autograph and I was fine with that, but I was so cool, you know, just sitting at that table with those guys. And mm-hmm. there were a few people that asked, and that was so cool and humbling and whatever, but I felt this tug on my jacket mm-hmm. as I'm sitting there. And Ted's sitting next to me mm-hmm. and I look down and Ted's pulling his hand back and he had just stuck an extra $200 in my pocket. In addition to what, you know, we had agreed I would be paid. I hadn't even, you know, gotten that envelope yet. This was just what he wanted to give me on the side. Ted looked out for me in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. He's been a good friend to me, and to this day he's somebody that if I need to, I can dial his number, and you know, he may not answer right away, but he'll definitely call me back.
I love
that.
It's really cool.
I'm honored to have that type of relationship with him.
Absolutely. And it's a testament to somebody who, you know, walks the walk and talks the talk. You know what I mean? It's one thing to to say the things and preach and to do all those things, but to literally, you know, in the face of somebody who was obviously going through a bit of a hard time and didn't really want to hear it at that time, turn around and kind of make himself available to be, you know, to maybe be a voice or somebody that could be a resource and help guide you a bit. That's really cool, man.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was, I mean, it wasn't just the Detroit trip. I mean, there were many shows after that and a couple of athletes conferences he took me to in Phoenix.
Yeah.
So, you know, zero complaints. Even when I screwed up really bad, and not in the ring, you know, personally between me and Ted, and he could have easily just said, you know what, I don't want anything to do with you.
Yeah,
he didn't. He loved me and he treated me with respect and love and like a real friend would, in my time, and you know, I'll never forget that.
That's really awesome. That's really great to hear, man. And I'm happy that you got to have that relationship with him. That's really cool. Did you, as you were doing this stuff with him and things like that, were you also still doing the likes of the ICW Mid-South stuff, the deathmatch stuff and things like that on the side? Were you balancing everything or were you kind of focused on that sort of stuff?
No, there was a bad falling out between me and Ian in 2000 or 2001, I don't remember which, but I was long gone from this area. I don't even think Ian was running in this area at that time. I think he was up in Illinois.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was doing a few things for Joe for Bad to the Bone Wrestling here and there and a few other independents around Kentucky and Tennessee. But I was comfortable in my little zone, you know.
Sure.
I didn't see in me what other people saw in me, and truthfully, that honestly did not come until I met my wife, and she kind of, you know, was like, look, you've stayed at this level. Now you need to, you know, put yourself out there. And as scared as I was to do it, had I not had her standing by me while I did it, I would have fallen flat on my face.
Yep.
And, you know, she saw me through it, and she doesn't get enough credit for, you know, the successes I had in the later part of my career, but it's all due to the fact that she had that faith in me.
Well, that's it. And I think it's a testament to how quite often we can't see certain things like that in ourselves, because there's, you know, obviously been quite a few people in your career, you know, your wife is the one that started to get that through to you, but obviously Ted saw something in you, you know what I mean? And any rest that I know, I have a couple of close friends from through the internet and through the podcast and stuff like that, that are referees, and they always speak really highly of you. One's DM Stevens. Is a close friend to mine. I talk really often to him. And another very close personal friend to me was a gentleman that we lost recently, Sean Patrick O'Brien, SPO. He and I were very close. And so as you tell these stories to me, a lot of the names you say when you talk about Isaiah and, you know, and things like and Louisville and, you know, Aaron and all this stuff, these are all people like that I know of through conversations with him. You know what I mean? OVW and all that stuff he telling about his coming up and things like that. And yourself, you know, all these people had all said, you know, positive things about you. When did you first meet Sean? Because obviously he's from the Louisville area. Did you guys get to work together? Because I mean, he cut his teeth in Mid-South, right?
Yeah.
I mean, after OVW, obviously. But
Yeah. And I think that's actually where we met. And it's funny because I had heard these grumblings about this new ref on the area. And, you know, he's really good and this, that, and the third. And when I met him, you know, he was very shy and reserved, very yes, sir. And I knew a lot of that he had gotten from, you know, hanging out with Isaiah and, you know, being around that influence.
He's a very respectful guy.
Yes, very, very respectful. And, you know, when Zaya came to me and was like, hey, this is, you know, this is little bro.
Yeah.
You know, I knew right then that, hey, if he's got Zaya's endorsement, then he's good. But, you know, me and Sean got along great. I when Bill Molnar needed extra reps for Vicious Outcast Wrestling in West Virginia and the Lord of the Anarchy stuff and all that, the first person I recommended was Sean. When we did Blackcraft, I said Sean. When Game Changer came somewhere, I think it was Tennessee, the first name that I threw out to Brett was Sean. Mm-hmm. You know, I was one of Sean's biggest fans.
Yeah.
We didn't talk like best friends. We didn't get to chit chat on a regular everyday basis, you know, but when we did talk, you know, it was like we never missed a beat.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had some professional, you know, animosity because, you know, we both wanted to be the best.
At, sure.
Yeah. We both wanted to be the best at what we were.
Absolutely.
You know? And, you know, I'm this OG kind of, you know, that's kind of how he looked at me, was this OG, you know, typo, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wanted to be that young kid still with that, you know, that fire and, mm-hmm. you know, grit and, mm-hmm. But, you know, even in the times we disagreed on things, we always spoke, and, you know, it never got into a, you know, a full-on argument with me and him, because mm-hmm. that's just not where we were. Mm-hmm. We were on a different level when it came to those things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I miss Sean. I think about him a lot. Again, so- we weren't best friends, but mm-hmm. I was certainly very happy to see all of the progress and the success and everything that he was doing at ICW, No Holds Barred, and, you know, the stuff he got to do at Game Changer, the stuff he did at IWA, mm-hmm. you know, everything that man accomplished, he accomplished because he put in the work.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't be happier to say he was a friend. Mm-hmm. I wish that I could have got to know him better.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that we could have worked more together. But I'll never forget all the times that we were on shows together. He never hesitated. John Gray, let's get a pic.
Yeah.
John, he probably in his phone had 100 pics of me and him.
Yeah.
And I was horrible, and I still am about it. You know, I see some of the guys, you know, from the local scene all the time, and I've got my phone in my pocket, and I don't think to take that picture, yeah. you know, to snap that memory.
Yeah.
And, you know, Sean was very adamant about having those memories. And, mm-hmm. I'm very thankful for that, because, you know, he would always post them, and now I have those in my memories, you know, that way. But,
mm-hmm.
I wished I would have taken more time to call him on a more regular basis and, you know, be a better friend than I was.
I know he really respected you. Like in conversations you were mentioned and stuff like that. I know he thought a lot of you, and I'm sure he learned a lot from you. It's one of those things that you just don't know till people are gone. You know what I mean? Like I never got to meet Sean in real space, you know what I mean? So it's really hard for me to talk about, because we spoke so often. Sorry. But even just screenshot each other or something stupid, you know? But,
right, yeah.
But he was like, people can just be gone, you know what I mean? And he's senseless passing. I really thought I could do it. sorry, John.
It's all good, man.
But
we've touched on a few sentimental subjects tonight.
We have. I'm putting you through it. I'm very sorry. But he was. He was a fucking special person who really touched a lot of people. And I knew that with you, it wouldn't be right to go through your story without touching on him. You know what I mean? Because he was in that same area and moving those same things. And I'd had those conversations with him, you know, talking about that scene and you guys and all that stuff. And it was all before I even knew what fucking independent wrestling was. You know what I mean? Like, I learned so much from guys like him and Corey from Deathmatch Worldwide and Jeremy Nicholson. They used to do their podcast together.
I love Jeremy. I need to message him. Jeremy, I don't know if you're going to see this, but if we're hear this, but if you do, buddy, I'm going to message you very soon. We need to get together.
He will absolutely listen to this. I think I'm the only wrestling podcast he still listens to. He doesn't have Facebook Messenger anymore, so you got to get him on Instagram. I can send you his account.
I don't have Instagram. Holy crap.
Oh, no. Come on,
all
guys.
Right, well, listen, Jeremy Nicholson, I hope you still have my number. If you do, it has not changed. Hit me up. Okay.
I'll tell him as well. I still talk to Jeremy. You know, he's been out of wrestling. He's got a beautiful family. You know what I mean? He met a lovely new lady and they got married and he's very happy. And so, like, I just love seeing it for him. But, you know, he had to step away from wrestling for a while. He was already sort of on the decline with it. And then with Sean's passing and stuff, it was way too – they used to do their podcast together every week. You know what I mean? It was his best friend. So, so it's –
Let me tell you a quick story about Jeremy. When my stepfather passed away, and we had to drive from New Jersey to Kentucky during the collective in 2019. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Nicholson made sure that we had enough gas to get there and that we had money to eat on to get there, and he made sure that we were taken care of. Yeah. And then when my mom passed away 24 days later, he did it again. Jeremy Nicholson is a class A human being. Anybody that has a bad word to say about him is going to have to fight me. That man
and me, I'm getting on a plane. Jeremy's the fucking man.
Yeah. And Jeremy has been there and helped me out in a lot of ways. Yeah. He's a hell of a man.
And he's had more than his fair share of hardships and
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
It's like that, you know what I mean? He just keeps pushing through and does the right thing. And seeing him now with his wife and his family, like, you know, he already had two boys. And then when he met Ruth, she came with some kids as well. So he's got a pretty fucking full house now. I think it's like five kids or something crazy. Like, and he's just, but he's so happy, man. Like, it's really, really good to see. So, yeah, Jeremy, message this man. Cool, John.
That warms my heart.
Yeah, yeah.
It really warms my heart to hear that. Jeremy's a class A man. Yeah. He's a class A character and, super, super cool guy.
Yeah. I really hope, and I'm really sad it didn't happen sooner, but I do hope that I eventually, you know, get to the States and get to be in real space with him and meet yourself and, you know, kind of meet everybody and move in these circles that I've heard so much about and spoken about and podcasted about and all this stuff. But, you know, it's all on the other side of the world.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. And I haven't seen Jeremy since, I think it may have been the Collective 2019, the last time I actually got to see him.
Sure. But, before and then the pandemic happens and fucking years of bullshit happened. Yeah. But like 2019 and stuff would have been like when I was starting to get into GCW and get, you know, into that stuff. I think it was 2019 is the only time I've been to America. My wife and I came to Vegas and got married when they did the first AEW pay-per-view, Double or Nothing. And I know GCW did shows around that sort of time and in the same sort of area and stuff. But, yeah, and then I've never gone back since because, you know, the world ended.
Sorry, my wife's getting ready to take the dogs to bed. I apologize.
No, no, that's okay. We can pause for a second if you need to.
I love you, babe. I'll be back here soon.
I'm proud of you.
I am too. You're good, babe. She got some good news. So.
Oh, that's good.
She was standing here. She was standing here patiently waiting to tell me about it, and then she shows it to me on her phone. I was like, "All right."
Oh, that's so good. Congratulations.
Yeah.
She's
a hard worker. We do the same job. She's a manager. I'm not because I don't want that smoke.
Yeah, fair.
And been there, done that, wore that t-shirt out. She's way better at it than I am. Sure. So, but we have the same job. We work at two different places, but it's the same company. It's, you know, I've wore a lot of hats in my life, but other than the hat of being a husband and a father, probably the third coolest hat I've wore, and not to disparage from being a referee, is the job that I do now.
Yeah.
Taking care of intellectually and developmentally disabled adults.
Oh, wow.
It is a giving job that when I come home at the end of the day, I don't sit and wonder, man, am I doing anything that's making a difference? I know every day that I've made a difference in my three clients' lives.
That's amazing.
And, you know, that is, to me, that's worth more than, I make good money doing it, don't get me wrong. But even if I didn't, what I get in return for all of that would well be worth it.
That's awesome. That's really great, John. All right. Well, I've taken you through the emotional ringer enough.
I don't know that we're quite done yet. There's still a lot to cover, Ross.
Oh, well, fuck. Well, let's liven it up a little bit. I've interviewed a lot of deathmatch wrestlers on this show, and it is like something that I really enjoy. And I do commentary with a couple of companies actually now that cover it. So let's get into that kind of stuff a little bit. Let's talk about becoming a deathmatch referee and what that was like for you. Was that like a little bit of a jump? They're like, oh, yeah, we're going to be throwing this stuff around. And you're like, what the fuck? Or were you like, let's go? Like, how did all that come about?
So I alluded earlier that, you know, IWA Mid-South, you know, was kind of the starting point, you know, because of the people I was able to meet and kind of get in front of. Mm-hmm. I always knew that death matches were kind of, I wanted to be involved in them in
sure.
some form or fashion. I don't necessarily know if it was the danger of it or, you know, if I wanted to prove to myself that I could dodge this shit.
Yeah.
No, I say that jokingly. I do. I say that jokingly because I am not acrobatic. I don't know what the allure was, really. I knew that was a genre of wrestling that I definitely wanted to dip my toes into and learn more about and kind of learn the magic behind it.
Yeah.
So, you know, that all started in 98 and, you know, of course I don't think it's talked about enough in deathmatch wrestling that to be a solid deathmatch wrestler. Okay. Mm-hmm. And there are exceptions to this. There are, but for the most part, to be good at deathmatch wrestling, you have to have a good wrestling background.
Mm-hmm.
You have
Absolutely.
To, you know how to use the gimmicks in the moves and so forth and so on. And again, there are exceptions to this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. People who, I don't want to say they're not great wrestlers, okay, because that would be disparaging to them, and I'm not going to do that. But, you know, maybe wrestling isn't – maybe pound for pound or hold for hold wrestling isn't their strong suit,
uh-huh.
okay?
Yeah.
It's not that they're not good at it. It's just not their best thing.
Yeah.
Happened, mm-hmm. okay? And no, I'm not going to name any names.
No, that's okay. I wouldn't ask you to.
Draw your own conclusions out there. But, you know, that certainly, you know, in order to be good at one, you kind of got to know how to do the other. And I knew that that was a part that I wanted to learn, but I knew there were going to be steps to get there. Did I dabble here and there? Yeah, sure. I did some thumbtacks and some glass and light tubes here and there. And Corporal Robinson once, you know, power bomb me in a big mess of stuff somewhere. You know, I think Todd Morton hit me in the head with a chair one night. You know, like, yeah. I did do some things here and there, but you know, it wasn't until many, many years later that I started to really get into, okay, I need to make this transition.
Yeah.
And once I did, it was very easy, to say the least. Now, were there times where I was extremely nervous? Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what's funny about that is neither one of the three times that I've ever been hurt in a ring was a time that I was nervous about being hurt in the ring.
Yeah.
So
those are the ones that get you, right? Happen. Those are the ones that get you. And it's funny, I speak to a few of my friends that are like, you know, deathmatch wrestlers and stuff. And they're like, dude, like, I would rather do this any day of the week. Like, they're like, any injury I've had ain't from deathmatch wrestling. Like, it's cuts and things like that. They're like, that's all cosmetic. When you blow a knee, like, on some move in, like, a real match, that puts you out for months. You know, I got a cut, I'm drinking beer at the bar the next day. Like, you know, that's sort of how they look at it, you know?
Yeah, so, but yeah, it really wasn't a hard transition for me. Certainly learning how to read the gimmicks and make sure that they were safe.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And that is something that there were a couple instances where I did not let my better judgment, or I did not err on the better side of my cautionary judgment, mm-hmm. and somebody got hurt.
Sure.
And, you know, while I've had conversations with those people because I carry that burden.
Yeah.
Okay. And they certainly don't blame me, mm-hmm. and that's all good. And I'm grateful for it. But at the same time, I saw something and I didn't say something. And as a result of my negligence, somebody got hurt.
Sure.
And I carry that with me more. That is a heavier scar for me than either of the two times I was cut in the ring or anything else that I've done, knowing that because I didn't do something that I should have done,
yeah.
somebody got hurt. I carry that with me every time I'm in a ring.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, when you, like you say, you're scouting those things and you're looking for it, and even if you're not 100%, it might be best to just remove it or to, you know, say something rather than just, like, let it play out, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't remember who. I can tell this story, I think. I've had the conversation with Trip Cassidy numerous times, and Trip is very, you know, gracious and, hey, you know, it wasn't your fault. I took the bump, blah, 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 you know. Yeah. But there was one of those, it was like a coffee table middle. Okay. It was certainly not glass that should have been in the ring.
Like, not tempered okay? glass. Yeah.
No, there was no, yeah, this was not tempered glass. Mm-hmm. And Trip went through it. It sharded. And I mean, it cut a vagina in his shoulder. Mm-hmm. it's not funny. It's not funny.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, like, and again, you know, not only did I see it, but other people seen it and pointed it out to me from the crowd and was like, hey, that should not be there. And I removed it from the ring once. It got put back, mm-hmm. and I didn't remove it the second time.
Yeah.
And I should have stuck to my guns and said, no, this is not safe. It's not getting used. I didn't. Trip Cassidy got hurt.
Yeah.
Had to have a bunch of stitches.
Yeah.
And I carry that with me. No matter how many times he says, John Gray, it's fine. It's not a big deal. I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
That's my job.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
What I'm in that ring for is to keep those guys as safe as humanly possible.
Yeah.
And a lot of times that does mean keep them safe from themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there was a similar story to that. And I'm trying to remember, like, when Cruel debuted for ICW, no holds barred, in the chains, you know, he comes out as a very big man, very scary, Jason Voorhees type character. He was versing Satu Jin, and there was a pane of glass in that got put in the corner, and he went through it, and it did that. It just, the glass didn't shatter. It just became a giant samurai sword and put a giant cut in him, right? He no-sells it. It's unbelievable. If you ever see the match, they stop the match. I'm trying to remember if Sean was reffing it. I think he was. Anyway,
I'm grimacing in pain at just the thought of that visual.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeez.
And he just he gets up and just kind of walks out, doesn't even sell it, but then obviously has to go to the hospital and stuff. I spoke to Cruel about it. It was crazy. I remember, who was it? I'm going to mince it. Anyway, whoever I was speaking to about it, I don't remember if it was Struggles or Sean or Danny, they had seen that piece of glass and it was the same thing. They were like, get that out. We don't want that one. But somehow during the match it got mixed in with other things. You know, people are bringing things in and it just got put in instead of like being thrown away. It's a junkyard, you know, the shit everywhere. But it somehow made its way back in and then, you know, these things happen, but it's horrible because it's like could have been avoided and it's just like somebody didn't hear that or whatever or didn't mark it or whatever and then, you know, something bad happens. So, you know, it's kind of the risk, but it just goes to show that when there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen, things like that can happen.
And I think part of it too is there, it's exactly what you said. There's too many cooks in the kitchen and a lot of those cooks don't know how to mix the ingredients.
Yeah,
okay?
Sure.
They don't know how to check the ingredients and make sure that they're within date and they're good.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, that's something that even gimmick makers need to learn.
Yeah.
You know, deathmatch workers do not want to work with, you know, pieces of wood. They don't want to work with, you know, glass that's going to shard and seriously injure them or the people around them, the crowd, anybody, you know. Light tubes may be the only exception to flying glass that deathmatch workers will, you know, use. And even then, I very rarely see people swing them in a haphazard way anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's more of a controlled bust than it is a wild swing. Let's see how far we can get this
Absolutely.
To go.
And then the ref obviously needs to be like on top of those shards and the ends and stuff. Like Sean used to always tell me, like, you know, the big U pieces, like I would always watch him and I'd watch him like step on them and crunch them and push them out and so and be looking for those bigger pieces and things like that. Like as a deathmatch referee, you've really got to have your head on a swivel, right? And be looking not only at the wrestlers, not only at the gimmicks they're using, but then also the debris, like the surroundings, because there's so much stuff happening.
And, you know, I think that's company-based as well because, you know, I worked for some companies, and I won't name them because they don't deserve to be named, but I worked for some companies that did not care if their workers were working in an unsafe ring full of shrapnel and, you know, in caps and, you know, crap. Mm-hmm. You know, they would just say focus on – you know, counting the three, don't worry about the stuff in the ring. Don't get in the way, this, that, and the third. And inevitably somebody would wind up at the hospital before the night was over.
Exactly.
You know, so Sean was actually one of the first reps besides myself that I saw breaking stuff in the middle of the ring, getting caps out of the ring. And I don't even remember what I want to say it was with Bill Monar, and it may have even been Connor Claxton. Big shout out, Connor Claxton. Love you, brother. That encouraged us refs to make sure that that stuff wasn't in the ring. And from that point forward, I always made sure that my guys were going to be safe.
Yeah.
Under, you know, any circumstances whatsoever, I'm not going to leave anything in the ring. I'm going to not put myself in danger in the same time, but I'm going to do whatever I can to keep them safe.
Yeah, absolutely. And are there any stories that you can think of right now, like do any tournaments where it's starting to get real hairy and you're just like, this is insane. I'm in a war zone right now.
Yeah.
you're like, lots.
quite a few of them. Yeah. All of them, every single one of them. I mean, the most famous of the injuries that I suffered, the one people ask me about the most is King of Deathmatch 2016, where I got hit in the head with a piece of shrapnel from a light tube.
Oh, really? But somebody swung it and it ricocheted off and got you?
So it was a four way. It was Ricky Shane Page, Marcus Crane, Josh Crane, and Del Patrick's. And I forget what the gimmick. I think it was like four corners of pain or something like that. They had like alcohol on one side and mouse traps, or you know, I don't remember. But there was obviously light tubes and such.
Yeah.
At one point in the match, about 10 minutes in or so, all four men are in the ring, and I just told you the four participants. Of the four, Ricky Shane is the biggest in the ring.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm behind Ricky Shane Page. They all four have a light tube in their hand. I know what's about to happen. It's the big four-way fucking, you know, smack yourself or, you know, smack each other, you know, gimmick.
Yeah.
I'm behind Ricky. I feel like I'm in the safest place possible because I'm behind the
biggest dude.
And it's nothing against Ricky, but of the four, you know, he was the one that was going to shield me the most.
And he's a pretty tall guy, isn't Ricky? Like
I love Ricky. He's an awesome guy.
Yeah,
awesome. Awesome to work with. Has a mind for this industry that is very rarely matched. Okay, he knows how to make the sizzle pop.
Yeah.
Okay. And he'll teach you if you watch him and listen and pay attention. Ricky's awesome. They all four swung, and we've watched the video, I don't know, a million times, and the end cap from Del Patrick's light tube. As they swung, his end cap comes off and catches me right next to my ear.
Brutal, the metal.
Right between my ear and my temple.
Ugh.
And, I mean, I just start leaking immediately. Sure. It hit me so hard, I thought somebody from the crowd had thrown a rock.
Yeah, wow.
That's how hard and fast it hit me. And I immediately felt that hot feeling on my face.
Yeah.
And then I saw the blood and I put my hand up on my face and I felt it and I looked and I'm leaning over my hand and I'll send you the raw footage. I have the raw footage of this.
Yeah.
I'm leaning over my hand and I'm looking at the blood just pouring out of my head onto my hand. And I'm like, oh my God, I fucked up. Oh, Ian's going to be so mad at me. Oh, my God. Ian's going to be so mad at me. Ian is going to be so fucking mad at me. That's all I'm thinking in that moment.
Yeah.
And the next thing I know, Nick Glenn, who was on commentary with Randy West, Nick Glenn grabs me, sticks a shirt that a fan had made for him and just given to him that day, sticks that shirt to my head.
Yeah.
And takes me to the U-Haul. Jimmy Lloyd was the other ref. God love him. He gets in the ring so awkwardly. Like, I don't know if I could get in here, but there's no ref. So I'm going to get in.
I got to do it. Yeah.
They cart me off to the back and Randy goes, she pulls the thing off my head And the blood just squirts. It's just squirting out of the side of my head at this point.
Jesus, yeah.
Ian's like, don't call an ambulance. They'll shut my show down. Here comes my wife.
Yeah.
And she's like, hey, it's you're all right. Calm down. You're okay. Calm down. And once I calm down, the squirting stopped.
Yeah.
You know, but my adrenaline's going, you know. You know, so Ian had Eric Harbo take me to the hospital. Mm. I walk into the hospital. blood's just pouring down the side of my head still. It's not squirting, but it's just pouring.
Yeah.
And they look at me and they're like, what happened? I'm like, look, I don't have a lot of time to explain this. I need you to stitch it up. I got to get back to the show. And the nurse says, the show? I said, yeah, look, just stitch it up. I got to go. And 10 minutes later, they're back there. They're stitching it up.
Yeah.
My wife is signing my admittance papers and my discharge papers at the same time.
In and out. Here we go.
Yeah. So this happens in the third match. I make it back in the middle of match five.
Yeah.
I referee the semi and the main events that night.
Jeez.
With my head wrapped up, 3 stitches in my head, just, you know, fucked up, you know.
Fuck it.
All I could think is, God, I hope Ian's not mad. Ian's not, right? You know, and I look back at it now and I'm like, why the fuck did I even care if he got mad?
Especially since you fucking got injured in his ring just doing your job. You didn't do anything wrong.
I'm not supposed to do that. Like, that's not my shtick.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't get hit with the weapons and bleed.
Yeah, so exactly.
Why should I care if he's mad?
Absolutely.
It took a while for me to get to that point.
Yeah.
I did. And you know, I didn't even get a thank you for that fucking show. fucking payday. Hell. I didn't even get a goddamn thank you. Yeah. So,
well, it's no wonder that you said that, you know, years later you would go on to have a big falling out with him and not work there anymore. So.
Oh, no. That was in 2002. We had made amends.
Oh, you made amends. You were back.
Yeah, we didn't speak from 2002 to 2009, I think it was.
Yeah.
You know, like, I had nothing for him. And then we didn't, after J.C. Bailey died, I didn't speak to him again for another 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, well.
Because of, you know, all the stuff that had gone on when J.C. Bailey had passed, you know, all the rumor and innuendo. And you know, I just didn't want to be associated with that.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. Eventually, me and Ian sat down and had a discussion, and hindsight is what hindsight is. You know, I drank the fuck Kool-Aid and got drunk. And there you go. You know, but I wasn't the only one. You know,
absolutely.
A lot of us did. Mm-hmm. And until we got to the point where we realized that IWA, as good as it once was not as good as it could have been.
Sure.
And never would be again.
Yeah.
Once we got that through our thick ass heads and went other places, that's when we were able to really grow in our careers. Mm-hmm. But it took me a long time to get there. And, you know, hindsight is what it is. I don't regret my time with Ian. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot there. I enjoyed a lot of the stuff I got to do there. Mm-hmm. I don't regret working there. Mm-hmm. I regret allowing him to make me feel like that was as good as I was ever going to get.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. That's what I regret. I've never met Ian. I've never been to any of those shows or anything like that. But over and over again, it's that same kind of story out of many people. You know what I mean? Like he must have had this charisma or this way about things where he just had this sort of ability to draw people to him and then keep them there. You know what I mean? Despite not treating them well, and, you know, it's just, It's crazy, but I guess that's, I don't know, how cults form. I don't know.
you know who else had that ability? David Koresh, okay?
These are promoters, right? David Koresh, he's a cult leader, was he? That guy? Fucking hell.
Getting up past you, Robbie.
I was like, is that another promoter? They was like, wait, that is a cult leader. yeah. Fucking hell. Yeah, absolutely. That's it. It's fucked, man. But, you know, you learn, you know, you live and you learn, and you had experiences there, and I'm sure it wasn't all tied up in him. It would have been the other people there and the crowds and the shows and all that different stuff. Mm-hmm. That all plays a part, you know. But, you know, it's all part of your development.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, he did help me to learn a lot of things.
Yeah,
a lot of
sure.
things. You know, so, it wasn't all bad. I wished I would have learned a few lessons then.
Absolutely. So, where are we, how did we come to sort of you haven't reffed in a while, obviously, and you were telling me before that you've got a, like, really rewarding career that you're really happy with now. At which point did you decide to sort of step away from refereeing and leave that behind you?
When I had to have the major surgery.
Right. Okay. This was your ear.
Yeah. And my very last match was Mickey Knuckles and Randy West at Ruthless Pro December 4th.
I know the match. I know Ruthless well. I know Chris and everything like that. And that was one of the first Ruthless matches I ever, that's where they're in the car park and fighting on a PT Cruiser and all this kind of crazy shit, isn't it? That one where it's all over the place? Or was it the one before that?
No, I don't remember. We were in a really small, I remember the ceiling was low.
Okay. Might have been the one before outside. That. Maybe I'm talking about the rematch.
I don't remember them going outside, but maybe they did.
Yeah.
And honestly, you know, a lot of what I've done in the last couple of years is kind of blurry because of this surgery.
Sure. Yeah.
I've relied heavily on film footage and you know, going back and watching some of the shows again and stuff like that to kind of remember some of the stuff that I've done.
Sure. Yep.
You know, again, for those that don't know, I had a very aggressive ear infection. Mm-hmm. It deteriorated three major bones in my ear, and started to seep into my brain.
Horrible.
And they had to go in and remove it all. And it was not a fun surgery. It was not a fun recovery process. But we made it through.
Yeah.
And, you know, am I in danger if I got into a ring? Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, I'm never going to be able to hear out of my right side again, you know, fully. And I certainly think that kind of puts me at a disadvantage because I feel like I need to be able to hear the communications in the ring.
Absolutely.
And if I can't do that, you know, again, am I effectively going to be able to do my job?
Sure.
You know, the other part of that is, my wife pushed me to become better. Mm-hmm. And ultimately she paid the price of what that entailed. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because I was gone all the time.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. 18 hours from Alabama to New Jersey.
Yeah.
You know, one way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those 26 hours from Alabama to Buffalo.
Yeah.
You know,
crazy.
One way.
Yeah.
You know, and it took its toll.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so I did what was, you know, in the betterment of my family and my health, and I couldn't be happier, you know, doing what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. What I like, you know, would I like something else maybe eventually? Yeah, sure. You never say never in wrestling. Never say never in wrestling.
Sure.
Am I actively out looking for things to do? No.
No.
I'm not.
Absolutely.
I'm quite content where I'm at.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's a really good place to be. You know, you can put those memories behind you. You can feel really, you know, proud of the journey that you went on and the things that you managed to do. But if you're in like a great place, you know, in your relationship, in your career, with your health, all those things, then you've won. You know what I mean? Like you're already doing really, really well.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so great, buddy. Tell everybody, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, at the end of the day, you know, I've got zero complaints. I've crowned kings, queens, princes, wannabes, lords, invitees, survivalists, you name it. I've probably done a tournament for it with the exception of Tournament of Death. I think that's the only one that I didn't get to do. Mm-hmm. Oh, and the Insane Eight. I didn't get to do that one either. You know, sure. The major deathmatch tournaments. Mm-hmm. In America, you know, I did Lord of Art Anarchy. I did Carnage Cup. I did numerous King of the Death matches. I did numerous Queen of the Death matches, numerous princes. I even crowned a wannabe once.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I even did a TPI. So there's not much outside of, you know, a TNA or an AEW or a WWE that I could see myself doing that's gonna top what I've already done.
Yeah that's awesome. You gave it all and left it all on the table and, you know, got to do those things. I mean, you said yourself at the very start, you know deer in the headlights and Sting and Shawn Michaels, you know, like as a young kid, who can say that, you know, that's crazy and that's a hell of a ride.
Yeah, and I mean this is at a time Sting is in TNA, and I think Sean is either getting ready or maybe he had just done the O2 comeback. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this was right after
Real
the
fresh.
0203 run for Shawn Michaels, the NWO type stuff.
All that stuff. Mm-hmm.
This was right after that, and he didn't actively wrestle on the show, but just to be a part of that locker room and be able to listen to them put everything together and why they put it together and how they put it, all that knowledge that mm-hmm. was in that room that day, mm-hmm. you know, and I got to be a part of that.
Really
and
cool.
at that juncture in my career, 6 years in, mm-hmm. I had no right to be there. So, you know, the fact that little old John Gray from Fairdale, Kentucky was able to do that was a dream come true. And truthfully, had it ended there, mm-hmm. I would have been content.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, I did it.
That's,
you know.
It's so awesome, dude. It's so awesome. Tell everybody where they can hang out with you, because I know I mentioned at the very start, but you were talking about your Twitch channel. You get on there and you're playing Rock Band and doing different stuff. How do people follow you?
Yeah, so I do Rock Band on Twitch. I try to do it a couple of nights a week, you know, sometimes more. I just became an affiliate, so mm-hmm. you got to subscribe if you don't want to see commercials. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Mm-hmm. But you can find me on there. It's The Wrestling Referee. You can find me on Facebook. I'm not sure. I think it's the same thing on Facebook, but yeah. I'll be honest, I don't get on Facebook very often. I watch a lot of videos on there, but that's every now and then I'll post something cool about, you know, my dogs or my wife, but very rarely do I do anything on social media. It's just so I miss MySpace.
Don't we all miss MySpace? Famous words from John Gray. Man, thanks so much for your time this morning. It was really great to get to know you. Thanks for being so open and candid and we touched on some emotional stuff today, and both of us, you know, nobody can see our faces, but both of us, you know, it meant a lot to me, man, and I really appreciate you being so open with me.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. You know, there's still so much we could have talked about. You know, there was a lot more to that collective weekend, you know, where my father passed, and more to the weekend after my mom passed. I mean, just so many great things that happened in that time span. Great, you know, things that I was able to share with people. And I'm so blessed to have been able to do that stuff. To all the guys that I got to share a ring with in the last 26 years, from certainly Tony Deppen and Marco Stunt, who gave me the most memorable match of my 26-year career, the weekend after my mother passed away in Chicago, Illinois. People like Drake Younger and Ted DiBiase and J.C. Bailey, who, you know, saw something in me.
Yeah.
I don't know what. Mm-hmm. But he saw something in me and went to his dad and was like, you got a rep. Go get him.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, it sounds like we're going to have to do a part two then, John, when we've got a little bit more time. I've got to get out of here and go to work. But I think maybe we should have a chat and talk about some other topics, and we can dive a little bit deeper at another time. How's that sound?
I'd love that, man. Mm-hmm. There's so much more I could talk about.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this was a good overview for everybody to kind of, if they're not familiar with John, start to understand where he sort of sits in the history of, you know, independent wrestling. I think that could be really cool. We could do some collective kind of stuff and some different stuff and just like choose some specific eras and kind of do a little bit more of a deep dive into it down the road a little bit, yeah?
I'd love that.
Yeah.
I'd love it.
I think that'd be awesome.
Whatever you have time for, man.
Yeah.
Whatever you have time for.
We'll do it. Maybe we can get Jeremy to dust off the mic one time and we'll get him in as well. Yeah.
I would love that.
Exactly.
I would absolutely love that.
Yeah. You might be just the one to motivate him to do it. So we'll we'll see what we can do. For everybody out there and for you, man, I just want to thank you so much for your time. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. We're going to have a bit more stuff this year, so don't worry. I'm not putting it away just yet. So, well, I've got plenty of plans, and it sounds like John and I will go a little bit deeper at another time. Yeah? Sound good?
I look forward to it. Thank you awesome. So much, man. I certainly appreciate your time tonight and inviting me on.
That's it. I absolutely appreciate you, man. You have a great evening, and we'll talk soon, yeah?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Excellent. So for the legendary John Gray, I know he doesn't like me to call him that, but I'm going to anyway. For Faces and Feels, remember,
thanks for
it's
listening.
All about peace.
Faces
love,
and Feels
and
is a proud member of the Count Out Podcasting Network. It is created and hosted by me, Rafe Houston, edited by myself and the amazing Ryan Neitzy, and the show is available on all good podcast platforms, so please go rate and subscribe. You can follow the show everywhere on social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, etc. at Faces Feels Cast. And you can check out the Count Out Network and all our sister shows over there at Count Out Pod. If you'd like to book me for commentary, have an interview request, a topic suggestion, or you just want to say hi, you can email us at facesandfeels@gmail.com. With all that said, thanks for listening and please support our friends and sponsors. Peace.
My body is a roadmap of pain.
DeathmatchWorldwide.com, the official online merchandise store that is only for Deathmatch Wrestling. Featuring official t-shirts from No Peace Underground, John Wayne Murdoch, Akira, Madman Pondo, Zona 23, Neil Diamond Cutter, G Raver, Schlack, Necro Butcher, and many more. If you are a deathmatch wrestler, promotion, manager, or platform, and are interested in joining the web store, send us an email to deathmatchworldwide@yahoo.com. Deathmatchworldwide.com for the violent few.
This has been a Count Out Podcast. Ring Post Radio is the only show hosted by Ryan Neitzy and Scotty Edwards that talks about the entire world of professional wrestling. With new episodes coming out every Sunday, there is absolutely no reason to not listen to real, honest wrestling opinions from two crazy maniacs. Have a hot boy summer and listen along to Ring Post Radio every Sunday on the Count Out Network.